we have reminded ourselves already of what Benson Baden wrote in their book about the necessity of observing the laws of God. As they state on page 41, we're bound by canon law and the penalties prescribed by canon law. On page 344, they wrote, if we observe his law, we will not be able to receive the sacraments from traditionalist priests who lack jurisdiction, since the Council of Trent has decreed that anyone who denies the necessity of jurisdiction is to be considered anathema. Denziger 903. If we observe his laws, we must observe them all, and as we have seen in parts 1 and 2, this is a tall order indeed. Having made it plain that they are bound to observe the laws of God and of his holy church, as are all Catholics, let us review Canon 1258, which states, it is unlawful for the faithful to assist in any active manner or to take part in the sacred services of non-Catholics, unquote. When you study their book and know what they have done during their lives, you will find that Benson Baden have actively taken part in non-Catholic services, being a member of the Novosordo Montini Schismatic Church and part of the Society of St. Pius X. And as they say on their back cover, they joined practically all the traditionalist movements and non-Catholic sects over the years. And then we should know Canon 2316, a person who of his own accord and knowingly helps in any manner to propagate heresy, or who communicates in sacred rites with heretics in violation of the prohibition of Canon 1258, incur suspicion of heresy. So now we see from the laws of the church that Benson Baden have incurred suspicion of heresy for being part of non-Catholic sects. In Canon 2315 we read, a person who is suspected of heresy and who after admonition has not removed the cause for suspicion shall be forbidden to exercise legal ecclesiastical acts. If he is a cleric and after repeated admonition has not removed the cause for suspicion, he shall be suspended ad divinas. If a person suspected of heresy has been punished with the penalties here stated and does not amend within 6 months after their imposition, he shall be considered as a heretic and be liable to the penalties for heresy. On page 352, they remind us, it should be obvious to all that if heretics participate, they could also be elected. And as Leo has said, a man who is not a Catholic could never be a pope. Beginning on page 345, Benson Baden wrote a section entitled Countering Objections. And by the time we get to page 354, we read the 10th objection. Question, by the strictest reasoning set forth in part 2, one of you is not even a Catholic in the eyes of the church. Having been born and baptized after the election of John the 23rd, how can we take the word of a non-Catholic? Answer. Allow me to introduce myself. I, David Baden, was born September 22nd, 1959, and baptized in Christ the King Church, Oklahoma City, in October of the same year. By the strictest interpretation, I am a baptized non-Catholic. The priest who baptized me apparently accepted John the 23rd as Pope, and therefore, according to Canon 2200, was a schismatic. However, his deflection from the faith is not certain, as it was not apparent, especially in this country, that John the 23rd was an anti-pope. Now, Catholicism consists mainly of the profession of the faith. If there was someone whom I could approach to be received with certainty into the church, I would jump at the opportunity. I submit myself to the pope for judgment. Concerning my profession of faith, you will find it in the pages of this book. The status of an author in the church does not affect the truthfulness of his statements. Truth must be believed regardless of the source. If then the electors wish to take the strictest view, which is advisable, and this disqualifies me from voting, then so be it. However, under the laws governing the use of the system of probabilism, they must take the same strict view and consider all priests ordained after the election of John the 23rd illicit as well, and therefore suspended from all exercise of orders. So here from his own statements, we find that David Bodden has doubts that he was a member of the true church. Or why did he write, if there was someone whom I could approach to be received with certainty into the church, I would jump at the opportunity. If Benz and Bodden would have truly thought themselves to be Catholics in good standing, as well as all the other electors, then why did they insist upon everyone participating in the election to take the profession of faith, as we've already covered from page 445. Good Catholics in good standing are not in need of taking an abjuration of error in a profession of faith. After having truthfully written that they are not Catholics in good standing, as we've just covered, we wonder why they wrote on page 309, we are Catholics in good standing, not excommunicates. That is just a blanket cover statement. How can they be Catholics in good standing when they belong to the Schismatic Church of Montini, as they describe on page 114? On page 362, they wrote, in a day and age when so few remain Catholic, the only reasonable and necessary qualification must be the demonstrable Catholicity of all voters. We have not taken this responsibility on ourselves, rather we have had it thrust upon us. We are qualified electors because God has not seen fit to leave us with any who are more qualified. We've already mentioned how they spoke practically the same thing on page 318. Papal election is ordinarily a jurisdictional act, but because there are none more qualified to perform this act, and for this reason only, we are allowed to proceed. On page 109, they wrote, a syllogism is proof of probability. Benz and Bodden clearly state they are not allowed to proceed with an election if there is anyone more qualified than themselves to elect a pope. On page 419, Benz and Bodden wrote, for as we have already seen, the promise of indefectibility to the church would never allow for holy orders, hence bishops and priests, to cease to exist. On pages 138, 139, 356, 357, and elsewhere in their book, Benz and Bodden also teach that truly Catholic bishops will always exist. Therefore, it follows that the true Catholic bishops who have persevered in keeping the faith are more qualified than a few non-Catholics who departed from the faith to elect a pope. And therefore, Benz and Bodden, on their own testimony, may not proceed to a papal election. Although they've done this, they themselves beforehand stated it would not be proper to do in the eyes of the church, nor lawful and licit before God in his holy church. Benz and Bodden taught this on page 360. In a doubt, the safer course should be followed. The doubt that they were Catholics was manifested by David Bodden in what we've just recently quoted from page 354. He doubted that he was a Catholic in good standing. And Benz and Bodden proved that all the electors, including David Bodden and Teresa Benz, were doubting that they were qualified electors, and therefore they made it very plain to us They all needed to take the abjuration of error. They also taught us very plainly that there can be no doubt, it's against the Catholic faith to doubt, that there are truly Catholic bishops living in the world, as well as Catholic priests who have not defected from the faith in any way. It simply follows that they are more qualified than Benzenbaden, and therefore Benzenbaden did not have the right to proceed with a papal election. Maybe this is the time to cover more extensively their objections of countering objections, starting on page 345. First question. Your substitute inside the front cover for an imprimatur does not satisfy me. If you are indeed such great lovers of the law, how can you excuse your violation, then, of the canon which prohibits anyone from publishing without ecclesiastical approval? Then we go to this inside the front cover and read their part about where is your imprimatur. And part of that reads, heresy is now so widespread and all persuasive that it would be impossible for most Catholics to learn the truth without assistance. These Catholics are in grave spiritual danger, whether they realize it or not. And in the common opinion of moral theologians, we must assist them, even at the risk of our own lives. Should we fail to render such assistance, we would ourselves commit mortal sin. We are therefore obliged to present here the truth, that our light might shine before men, for the supreme law is the salvation of souls. And it is true that they are obliged to present the truth, part of the truth that Benzenbaden did show is the fact that true bishops existed elsewhere. But because there were true bishops, they would not and could not give an imprimatur to this book, because although Benzenbaden presented part of the truth, they also presented many contrary errors, saying, in the same book, these bishops do not exist, and some of the things I have already covered. Why did Benzenbaden totally excuse themselves for not doing the one truly important thing they should have done? Go and seek out the true shepherds left in this world. Work with them in electing a true pope. Toward the end of this first objection, Benzenbaden wrote, in a conflict of law, the higher law prevails. Hence, we are allowed to faithfully relay the faith, to defend the faith, and to increase our faith among each other by written and other means. Strict precautions must be taken to guard against errors. But, as in all else, God will come to the aid of those who are pure of heart and keep His law. So Benzenbaden remind us they must faithfully, and they emphasize that in their book, faithfully relay the faith. That means not to put in contrary things or write something and then not observe it themselves. And they must be strict in taking care to guard against errors, which means there should be no contradictions, not stating one thing and contradicting it later. But as in all else, God will come to the aid of those who are pure of heart and keep His laws. They've shown in their book the laws of the necessity of an abjuration of error, profession of faith, for those who have been members of non-Catholic sects before they're eligible to vote in a papal election. This never took place for Benzenbaden and their other electors. And therefore, let us question and find out why they did not keep the law, after saying here in their book that they would do so. Objection 2, question. What you have written is only your opinion. Why should we believe you when our priest, who spent 8 years in the seminary, has far more training and knowledge than a layman? Benzenbaden's answer. Unless your priest has somehow retained his jurisdiction, which is indeed a rarity, he is transgressing the laws of the church, and encouraging you to commit sacrilege and committing mortal sin himself by violating the suspension he incurred when he heard that first confession without the proper jurisdiction. If he is so knowledgeable, why would he do such a thing? What we have written is not merely our opinion. In fact, we have not so much written as we have presented what duly approved pre-1958 authors have written, most of whom are theologians. In the main, we have based all our arguments on the teachings of the Magisterium itself, and whenever interpretation was employed, we have endeavored to use the soundest and most irreproachable sources possible, including doctors and fathers of the Church, as well as eminent canonists. If you wish to argue, you must argue with the Church, not us. When you first read this answer to the objection, it seems very good and sound and like a nice cover-up, but when you study the book, it simply is not true. If it was true, why are there so many contradictions? If it was true, why can they state we are Catholics in good standing after proving they've been to non-Catholic religions? If it was true, how did they conclude that non-Catholic lay people, maybe men and women, would be more qualified to elect a pope than true Catholic bishops? And here to begin their answer, unless your priest has somehow retained his jurisdiction, which is indeed a rarity, he is transgressing the laws of the Church and encouraging you to commit sacrilege and committing mortal sin himself, and so on. And yet, on page 445 and other places in this book, we find that Benzenbaden are absolutely relying upon these same priests, these rarities, ones they have never found, to somehow have that jurisdiction to be able to bring all of these electors back into the Church, hear their confessions, absolve them in the external form first. Well, Benzenbaden did not find these rare priests, and therefore they violated the laws of the Church they themselves brought out. They did not follow what they preached in so many places. As part of their answer to this objection too, remember, Benzenbaden wrote, what we have written here is not merely our opinion. And yet, looking at what they have actually written, we find there are many just statements with no quotes, as they go on to say. In fact, we've not so much written as we have presented what duly approved pre-1958 authors have written. But they did not provide the proofs that they explained they should provide on page 14 of their book. I have another booklet here in my hand titled St. Therese Returns by Albert H. Dolan, Order of Carmel, A Defense of Fundamental Catholic Teaching. Under chapter 2, page 18, there's something that's important to understand. Quoting, by way of preliminary, let me formulate some principles which will serve as excellent guides whenever in your reading you encounter any objection against religion in any of its departments. First principle, the most important of these guides is this. It is one of the first principles of logic, of correct thinking, that mere statement is not proof. I wish that all my auditors who read a great deal would try to engrave that principle upon their memories. Mere statement is not proof. Modern journalism and current literature abound in statements for which no proof is offered. And if that principle is kept in mind, it will guide you safely over 9/10 of the irreligious material that you meet in your reading. I shall not apologize for repeating that principle often during this series of talks. Just what do I mean by quote, mere statement is not proof, unquote. Let me illustrate. In my talk last week, I proposed some 20 objections to Christianity in the form of statements taken from the New York Press, and I offered no proof for any except one of those statements. To say, quote, the days of dogma are over, unquote, proves nothing. It is a mere statement without proof. I could encounter the statement with another contradicting it, quote, the days of dogma are not over, unquote. Again, the following statement, quote, the idea of God is an antique, the notion of God originally developed from a primitive fear of the unknown. Psychoanalysis and behaviorism have demonstrated that man is not responsible for his actions, unquote. All these are statements, and merely statements, proving exactly nothing. But there is one type of smart statement which recurs continually, against which permit me particularly to warn you, and that is a statement beginning with the words, quote, no intelligent man nowadays believes, unquote. Modern unbelievers are very fond of that phrase. If they wish to indicate their own private disbelief, they say not, quote, I do not believe in creation or in hell or in immortality, unquote. No, they say, quote, no intelligent man nowadays believes in creation, unquote. Or they vary it a bit by saying, quote, every intelligent man knows that man's responsibilities for his actions has been long since disproved, unquote. Or they say, quote, the modern trained mind cannot accept the miracles of Christ, unquote. Do not be disturbed by such statements, my dear friends. They are all violations of the first principle of logic, violations of the first rule of the art of thinking, namely, that mere statement is not proof. The answer to all such objections is the same, namely, prove your statement. When a man says, quote, no intelligent man nowadays believes this or that, unquote, the answer is, quote, you mean your mind cannot believe, unquote. For it is simply not true that every modern trained mind disbelieves. On the contrary, I can give you a formidable list of highly intelligent men of giant intellect who do believe what you deny. So much for the very important principle to be remembered in all our reading, quote, mere statement is not proof, unquote. So when people make mere statements, either verbally or at least mentally, say, prove it, prove your statement. And that's what Benz and Baudin are obliged to do, is prove what they have said is always the truth. Prove that they are Catholics in good standing, not excommunicated. Prove that they are the most qualified voters. Prove that non-Catholic laymen can elect a pope when there are true bishops living. Prove it. Protestants and non-Catholics, even these people whom you recognize as not popes, Paul VI, John Paul II, whoever, make statements, some of which are truly orthodox and Catholic. They have said, for example, we should pray the rosary. That's a true statement. We should pray the Most Holy Rosary. But you read the rest of what they state, and it is contrary to the teachings of the Church. Much of it. Another example, the man who is known as Bishop Francis Conrad Maria Schuchart gave a talk trying to justify his receiving orders in the old Catholic line. One statement he made strikes me very strongly. The old Catholics kept the most perfect records of any place in the world. Prove it. You look in that book, Bishops at Large by Peter Anson, and you'll find they kept no records. Very many secret ordinations and consecrations. Where do they get the proof? How does Francis Schuchart prove that the abjuration of error before 30 lay people by the so-called bishop Daniel Quitter Brown brought him back into the true church? That was Schuchart's whole basic line, that he was himself a Catholic because Brown abjured his errors, but it was only done before lay people, none of whom could absolve them or him and bring him back into the church. The same sad fact happened with Benson Bodden. They abjured, I suppose, but if they did do it at all, it was only before lay people who themselves were outside the church. Let Benson Bodden provide the real proof that they were brought back into the Catholic Church before they attempted the papal election. Then maybe we can see whether we should follow Bodden as a pope. Prove the basic things and then proceed. Number three of their questions against them. But you're positively anti-clerical. You teach that wicked ministers cannot confect valid sacraments. This is Adonistist heresy. Their answer. On the contrary, this is the teaching of St. Thomas, St. Pius XI, as well as the Council of Trent. And here I'm not trying to be critical about them, but there must be a misprint in their book. Who is St. Pius XI? I've never heard of him, but that's what they wrote in their book. I'm not sure what Pope Pius they're speaking about. And I'm not sure how they came to this statement of this objection of part three. You teach that wicked ministers cannot confect valid sacraments. This is a Donatist heresy. Well, I state that if Benson Bodden are truly teaching that wicked ministers cannot confect valid sacraments, then that's also their heresy. The answer Benson Bodden give are, on the contrary, this is the teaching of St. Thomas, St. Pius XI, as well as the Council of Trent. What is the teaching of St. Thomas, St. Pius XI, and the Council of Trent? That wicked ministers cannot confect valid sacraments? Whoa, friend, just the opposite. St. Thomas and the Council of Trent teach that wicked men do confect valid sacraments. Opening now the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas, we turn to question 19, article 5 of the supplement. Under this fifth article, it is asked whether wicked priests have the use of the keys. Objection 1. It would seem that wicked priests have not the use of the keys, for in the passage where the use of the keys is bestowed on the apostles, John 20, verses 22 and 23. The gift of the Holy Ghost is promised. The wicked men have not the Holy Ghost. Therefore, they have not the use of the keys. But in reply to this objection, St. Thomas Aquinas gives the teachings of the Catholic Church when he says, on the contrary, no man can know whether another man is in the state of grace. If, therefore, no one could use the keys in giving absolution unless he were in the state of grace, no one would know that he had been absolved, which would be very unfitting. Further, the wickedness of the minister cannot void the liberality of his Lord, but the priest is no more than a minister. Therefore, he cannot, by his wickedness, take away from us the gift which God has given through him. St. Thomas goes on when he says, I answer that, just as participation of a form to be induced into an effect does not make a thing to be an instrument, so neither does the loss of that form prevent that thing being used as an instrument. Consequently, since man is merely an instrument in the use of the keys, however much he may through sin be deprived of grace, whereby sins are forgiven, yet he is by no means deprived of the use of the keys. But there is more here that possibly Benson Bodden were referring to that made them form their opinion. It's very confusing what they said, but for the sake of those who are involved in the many false religions of the traditionalist movement today, let us go on here to cover what St. Thomas said in Objection 3 in this fifth article. Further, Augustine says that God gives the sacrament of grace even through wicked men, but grace itself only by himself or through his saints. Hence he forgives sins by himself or by those who are members of the dove. But the remission of sins is the use of the keys. Therefore, sinners who are not members of the dove have not the use of the keys. So that's someone's objection, and now St. Thomas gives the Church's teaching in reply. Augustine speaks of the remission of sins insofar as holy men cooperate therein, not by virtue of the keys, but by merit of congruity. Hence he says that God confers the sacraments even through evil men, and among the other sacraments, absolution, which is the use of the keys, should be reckoned. But that through members of the dove, that is, holy men, he grants forgiveness of sins, insofar as he remits sins on account of their intercession. We might also reply that by members of the dove, he means all who are not cut off from the Church. For those who receive the sacraments from them receive grace, whereas those who receive the sacraments from those who are cut off from the Church do not receive grace, because they sin in so doing, except in the case of baptism, which in cases of necessity may be received even from one who is excommunicate. And now I, Patrick Henry, comment that I hope people understand what St. Thomas, the Prince of Theologians, just explained. If you receive sacraments from those who are cut off from the Church, which includes the priests in the traditionalist movement, because they never were called to the priesthood by any true ecclesiastical authority, they are cut off from the Church. When you go to the sacraments to those men, you do not receive grace because they sin in so doing, except in the case of baptism. And now we go on to the sixth article. Whether those who are schismatics, heretics, excommunicate, suspended, or degraded have the use of the keys. Objection 1. It would seem that those who are schismatics, heretics, excommunicate, suspended, or degraded have the use of the keys. For just as the power of the keys results from orders, so does the power of consecration. But the above cannot lose the use of the power of consecration, since if they do consecrate, it is valid, though they sin in doing so. Therefore, neither can they lose the use of the keys. That's the objection, and now St. Thomas writes on the contrary. St. Augustine says that the charity of the Church forgives sins. Now it is the charity of the Church which unites its members. Since, therefore, the above are disunited from the Church, it seems that they have not the use of the keys in remitting sins. Further, no man is absolved from sin by sinning. Now, it is a sin for anyone to seek absolution of his sins from the above, for he disobeys the Church in so doing. Therefore, he cannot be absolved by them, and so the same conclusion follows. And St. Thomas continues, I answer that, in all the above, the power of the keys remains as to its essence, but its use is hindered on account of the lack of matter. For since the use of the keys requires in the user authority over the person on whom they are used, as stated above, in question 17, article 2, The proper matter on whom one can exercise the use of the keys is a man under one's authority. And since it is by appointment of the church that one man has authority over another, so a man may be deprived of his authority over another by his ecclesiastical superiors. Consequently, since the church deprives heretics, schismatics, and the like, by withdrawing their subjects from them either altogether or in some respect, in so far as they are thus deprived, they cannot have the use of the keys. And I will continue by reading the reply to this objection 1 given above. The matter of the sacrament of the Eucharist on which the priest exercises his power is not a man but wheat and bread. And in baptism, the matter is simply a man. Wherefore, just as were a heretic to be without wheat and bread, he could not consecrate. So neither can a prelate absolve if he be deprived of his authority. Yet he can baptize and consecrate, albeit to his own damnation. So, my dear friends of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, we have just learned that the Novus Ordo clerics, even if they would happen to have valid orders, and the Traditus Movement clerics, mainly those coming from Archbishop Took and Lefebvre, as well as the freelance priests, if they joined the non-Catholic Novus Ordo religion, they were participating in non-Catholic services. They lost their office authority and jurisdiction. Therefore, they can no longer absolve you. And those who participate with them in their sacraments, because they are cut off from the church, do not receive grace. Because the summa is open to this section, I will continue with explaining something under question 20. And the reply to objection 2, St. Thomas Aquinas teaches us, in the case of excommunication, absolution from which should precede absolution from sin. For as long as a man is excommunicated, he cannot receive any sacrament of the church. Do you comprehend what the church is teaching us here through St. Thomas Aquinas? If people were once Catholic, then they left that true faith, or for any other reason, joined a non-Catholic sect, they are excommunicated, and the church teaches they must first be absolved in the external forum before they can be absolved from their sins. That's the need for the profession of faith and the abjuration of error. The Traditionist Movement clerics very, very seldom use this teaching of the church. They neglect it, and therefore they do not follow the Catholic faith. They say confession alone suffices, but we know now that it does not. So now you know positively that St. Thomas Aquinas teaches the exact opposite of what Benz and Bodden say they teach on page 346, where they teach that wicked ministers cannot confect valid sacraments. Then they told us this is the teaching of St. Thomas. Well, we found out from his summa, this is not the teaching of St. Thomas. He does teach that ministers can confect valid sacraments. And in their book on page 289, Benz and Bodden reminded us how important it is to listen to St. Thomas Aquinas when they wrote, "The testimony of this doctor alone proves our case, since Pius XII averred that you can believe everything St. Thomas said." Now we turn to The Sources of Catholic Dogma by Denzinger under number 860. To prove that the Council of Trent is also contrary to what Benz and Bodden teach. Here the Sacred and Ecumenical Council of Trent teaches under the canons on the sacrament of baptism, canon number 4, If anyone shall say that the baptism which is also given by heretics in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit with the intention of doing what the church does is not true baptism, let him be anathema. So we see that Trent does teach heretics, wicked men, can confect valid sacraments. This subject is covered in quite a few places in Denziger's book. Under 169, it tells us very plainly that schismatic bishops can confer sacraments. It also goes on to explain the same place. Therefore, then, this person has only injured himself by wickedly administering the good, for the inviolable sacrament which was given through him held the perfection of its virtue for others. And the sacred council under the canons on the sacraments in general states under canon 12, if anyone shall say that a minister who is in mortal sin, although he observes all the essentials which pertain to the performance or conferring of the sacrament, neither performs nor confers the sacrament, let him be anathema. And in Denziger's under 902, we find the Council of Trent teaching. It also teaches that even priests who are bound by mortal sin exercise as ministers of Christ the office of forgiving sins by virtue of the Holy Ghost conferred in ordination, and that they are of an erroneous opinion who contend that this power does not exist in bad priests. So reviewing again what Benzenbaden wrote under this third part on page 346, they state, it is not because the ministers are wicked that we claim that they cannot administer valid sacraments, but because the council infallibly decreed that the sacrament of penance cannot be validly administered by those who do not possess delegated jurisdiction. And in that statement, they are correct. The priest needs jurisdiction, but the way they worded the top part of this question and answer was heretical, and it maybe just needs to be clarified that they probably were correct in their own thinking, but just wrote it somewhat in this book in a way that was contrary to what the church teaches. If you read the whole paragraph, then they seem to have it correct that wicked ministers can administer valid sacraments but not absolve someone because they lack jurisdiction. But here again we continue on with their next sentence under the answer to part 3. The Pope is the originator of such jurisdiction, and unless we wish to deny that he has the fullness of said jurisdiction, which is also a de fide teaching, Denziger 1823, we cannot pretend that these priests possess it in his absence. Here again, Benzenbaden, it seems, should have been more specific what they meant by these priests, because the truth of the matter is, bishops and priests do possess jurisdiction during a period of interregnum. If they had jurisdiction before the Pope died, that is, of course, if they did not lose their jurisdiction. But as written here, Benzenbaden are trying to teach, it would seem, that priests do not possess jurisdiction in the absence of a Pope, which is wrong. There are true bishops and true priests in the world as I speak right now, 1998, that do possess jurisdiction, although there's been an absence of a Pope since 1958, over 40 years from the time I speak right now. Let us continue to review together these objections and answers, questions and answers that Teresa Benz and David Bodden put together in their book, and we will pick up again on side B of this tape.